Thank you, everybody. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm with the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS, and so I want to welcome everyone to be here. But in particular, I want to welcome State Secretary Liv Monica Stubolt, did I get it correct, who has agreed to come and speak to this group. And it's an informal type setting. She'll have a few words to say at the beginning and then answer some questions. But I think it's always important when we're looking at energy issues to have the opportunity to hear a perspective from Norway. I think Norway has been a leader in many ways in managing their oil production in a way that does not disrupt the economy. They're also now, I think, a leader in how you develop the energy resources and petroleum resources with an eye towards what it's doing environmentally. And that's really the main theme of today's presentation, is this development of petroleum resources in an era where environmental consciousness has really come forward. So, Madam Secretary, if you would like to begin.
Thank you very much. Non-charismatic sounds ungenerous, but he was a bit of a hangdog look and a hangdog approach to things. But he's very good Prime Minister for Norway. He visited the United States and New York about 30 years ago, and he was asked by a U.S. reporter whether he was concerned and disappointed about the fact that Norway was almost never mentioned in American news. And he said, I've been told that since World War II, Norway has been on the front page of the New York Times two times. Once was when we had a huge oil platform that capsized, killing a number of people. Second time was when Germany invaded Norway. Based on that experience, I would prefer to stay out of the news. And I agree with that sentiment. I think it makes a lot of sense. And the story illustrates something which is very relevant to the energy agenda today, and that is the agenda, i.e. what we discuss, is a problem-driven, a worry-driven agenda. And Norway, despite the fact that we are the fifth largest oil exporter in the world, the third largest gas exporter, about to be the second largest gas exporter in the world, despite the fact that we're the sixth largest hydropower producer in the world, despite the fact that every third or fourth meal cooked in United Kingdom, Germany and France is being cooked with Norwegian gas, nobody really talks about us. To be quite frank, nobody really makes a big fuss about Norway as an energy supplier, although we are way up there in a diverse group, to put it like that. Russia, right, Algeria, right. Saudi Arabia, etc. And from that point of view, the Norwegian international energy policy is trying to balance between the need to be sufficiently visible that we're not in the line of fire when people are adopting measures, policies, and strategies aimed at somebody else, with the ambition of holding on to Prime Minister Norli's objective, stay out of the press, if it's problem and crisis driven. Now, this means that Norway is very much part of the international equation on energy supply and energy security. Norway is very much part of the equation with regard to future potential for development of the energy resources, which will be necessary to meet demand as we move ahead. At the same time, Norway is, and would like to continue to be, at the forefront of the group of countries that drive the international negotiations forward on climate. We would have liked the Bali outcome to have been much more ambitious, much more concrete, and we were among the most ambitious countries with regard to setting targets, including the objective of staying out of the plus 2 degrees Celsius, etc. So, ladies and gentlemen, with regard to environmental policy in terms of climate change. We have a situation where we do contribute a lot to emissions if all the oil and gas we export is being counted. If one should think of making us accountable for all that is produced on the Norwegian continental shelf, and thank God people rarely do, but if we should be made accountable for all that we were exporting, we would be a big part of the problem. At the same time, we are among the first to hammer out a policy to target and curb emissions, meaning that we are both the hammer and the nail. Now, if I set a punctuation here, it would be a bit like, you poor woman, you have a schizophrenic life. We wish you the best of luck. But I hope to be able to share with you some of the ways that we have found to come around this seeming paradox. Now, firstly, we try to analyze the world in a sober manner. And that tells us that energy will be required. Fossil fuels may not be taken out of the equation for decades to come. I know someone, maybe including us, would have liked for us to be able to embrace a completely renewable energy world tomorrow. It's not possible. It is simply not possible. We know that sort of mid-scenarios tell you that if we're successful with the development of renewable energies, which is part of why I'm here participating and why I reckon all of that, the mid-scenarios tell us that renewables will absorb part or at the maximum the whole of the growth in demand. So it doesn't really address the problem in the short and mid-term. Those are the facts. Those are the facts. And then if you stick to the facts, you have to look at what that means with regard to how fossil fuel producing countries should move forward. Now, our three-prong approach is identical to everyone else with regard to climate change. It is energy efficiency, renewables, and development of environmental technologies to ensure cleaner production and cleaner use of the fossil fuels that we have. Everybody agrees that that is the way forward. But what we've said is that we have to find our own national approach to that. And I think it makes sense for all countries to look at what are our own strengths and apply those. Now, we have two obvious strengths in this context. Firstly, we have a lot of good engineers. We have a lot of technologically highly proficient, state-of-the-art competence and know-how on a lot of things. A lot of it coming out of the petroleum industry, but I'd also like to emphasize the hydropower, other types of strong clusters in Norway. I could also mention the maritime industry. Now, so we have a lot of people who know how to do things in a smart way. That's one strength. The other obvious strength is that we have a lot of money. Now, capital is not a scarce asset in this world today. It is not a scarce asset as such. But money applied with a long-term, community-orientated objective, that's much more scarce. So what we've decided is that we would like to put some of the profits out of a high oil price into developing environmental technologies and renewables, and we've particularly picked the ambition of developing carbon capture and storage technologies. And this is why we've chosen to take carbon capture and storage, because it is what I think correctly may be defined as a bridging technology. carbon capture and storage is something which will be extremely helpful for decades to come, but it is a bridging technology because I truly believe and I truly hope we will one day attain a renewable energy society, and then we will not need carbon capture and storage for fossil fuel production. But it is crucial that we have bridging technologies of which this is the best show in town as we speak. Maybe not the only, but it is the best and the most substantial way forward. The International Energy Agency supports us in saying that they think that the curbing of emissions required will have to be dealt with at the level of 20 to 28% on carbon catch and storage, i.e. they say this is a sine qua non. There is no way that we will reach the targets that everybody more or less agrees upon unless you use carbon catch and storage. 20 to 28%. We see some enthusiasts saying carbon catch and storage should absorb up to 50% of the necessary reductions. I think that's inflated. I think 20 to 28 is a robust assessment. That's a lot, ladies and gentlemen. That's shy of one third. Now, this means that we consider that we can be of help in abating the global challenge of climate change if we contribute substantially to carbon capture and storage. In very concrete terms, this means that we have decided to put government funds into building two full-scale projects on the west coast of Norway. One of them will be a retrofit to an existing gas-fired combined heat and power plant, gas-fired. And the other one will be first a pilot facility and then a full-scale facility on a gas-fired power plant we're about to build. Thereby, we hope to do two things, both testing out not fully tested technologies on the new plant and to upscale existing known technologies on the retrofit facility. If we succeed in doing that, we are doing something that in an ideal world, business should be doing themselves, i.e. go in, clean up and make the product more likable, more sellable and cleaner. We believe that in the long term, it will be attractive to go into a carbon dioxide value chain and to have a commercially driven objective and business of capturing and storing carbon dioxide. But, ladies and gentlemen, we're not there today. So our mission is not to replace business. It will have to come, and we see some promising signs that it is about to come. But we hope to speed up the process. We hope to speed up the process by giving very clear signals that we want to go down the road of carbon catch and storage by putting up money and by establishing these demonstration projects, thereby making it attractive for business to think along the lines of how they can get the engineering and production contract on these two facilities. Now, this is only the first step of the two necessary steps. Because if we succeed in making sure that carbon catch and storage technology is being enhanced and developed and mastered, then that is not enough. If it's so expensive to do that it's only Norway and a few other countries that also do not appear on the front of the New York Times, that will be able to use it. That is completely irrelevant to the world. And that's why we believe that we have to keep our eye on the target, that it needs to be developed, but we also need to make the carbon catch and storage technology deployable, that is cost efficient. I remind you of the conclusion of the Commission of Sustainable Development here in New York, the UN body, in 2006. It went down for 2 weeks, and it boiled down to one sentence that everyone agreed upon. And that was, without affordable renewable energy, there will be no development. Now, I thought it was quite an interesting event when the Commission of Sustainable Development concluded that, because it was the first big event where you got all the energy people and all the environmental people and all the development people to actually speak to each other about the same issues. And I think they are right. Without affordable and environmentally friendly, carbon ideally neutral, but at least with a low carbon footprint, energy sources, development is going to be impeded to the extent there is no way we'll be able to attain our Millennium Development Goals. Therefore, we believe that the task we have set ourselves is not to clean up 2 gas-fired power plants on the west coast of Norway. That's interesting in the domestic discussions. People go on and on and on about the cleaning up of the carbon dioxide of these 2 gas-fired power plants. That's completely uninteresting when you leave Norway. What do you mean gas? Are you cleaning up gas? Right. Why aren't you cleaning up coal or lignite or tar sands? Because it is a testing facility. It is a laboratory that we have decided to use full-scale, develop technology, and then to speed up the process of developing the technology and thereby making it available for industry to do what industry does, attack something which is there and make it more cost-efficient. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I do not believe that the Norwegian government is able to or even should attempt to make that technology cost-efficient. That is a classic commercial business thing to do. But they cannot start doing that until the technology is actually developed. So the whole outcome of the political attention and the resources and the money that we're putting into this is speeding up the process. That would be success in our book. If we speed up the process of making carbon catch and storage technology available earlier than it would have had if we had not intervened, then I think we have made a small contribution. So that is one part of trying to direct some of the boon out of high oil prices into developing something which will make the further use of fossil fuels for decades to come acceptable in carbon neutral ambition. The other measure that we've decided to pursue, which I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, but I would like to mention, is less related or not at all related to our own reality in Norway. But that is that we've decided also to put up a lot of money for measures against deforestation, rainforest. And that was announced by Norway in Bali because we think it makes a lot of sense to stop reduce deforestation. And I have to quote the Prime Minister of Norway, Jens Stoltenberg, because after a domestic intense debate on carbon catch and storage for months and months about technology this and technology that and amino technology or full scale, and you know, all politicians dealing with energy needs to be experts now, needs to be, you know, quasi engineers. After months and months of this, he came to Bali, his shoulders went down, he said, I'm putting up huge sums of money for deforestation measures. And he was leaning back in the chair as we were having a press conference, and he said, at least we have the technology of how not to cut down a tree. And that's an illustration that to actually achieve, you know, curbing of emissions, technology optimism is one thing that we share with the present administration in the U.S. But the one thing we do not share is that that is the only route to go down. So I respect the technology of optimism that President Bush voiced in his speech this morning in Wyrek. I share that technology optimism, but I think it's blinkered to do that only. And to say that this is what we do And this is how we are going to resolve the challenge of climate change. We do not believe that this is enough in and of itself. Now, I will close off by saying that we also try to have a closer dialogue with fellow petroleum-producing countries on this issue. And that is because we hope and believe that the existing dialogues that we have both multilaterally and bilaterally with other strong petroleum-producing countries, and I will mention the Russian Federation and many of the Gulf states in that context, has been going on for years. It is a good and long-standing dialogue. We have adopted a very clear strategy to use that platform of being fellow producers and knowing these people well to argue in favor of measures to curb emissions of carbon dioxide. And the minister, Mrs. Oslo Haga, and myself, in the course of the last 2.5 months, have visited Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait with a very clear ambition of encouraging and inviting to both bilateral and multilateral cooperation on environmental technologies. And I will close my remarks by saying that we came back from those from meeting with those leaders of those four countries with an impression that they are more prepared to entertain the thought of using petroleum-producing profits for environmental technologies and renewables than many would have thought. I think it is wise to check some prejudices in the door with regard to other big petroleum-producing countries. I do not want to investigate the whys and the incentives and the motivations, because I'm trying to be pragmatic about it. Are they prepared to be part of the solution or not? And I remind the audience of the decision made by the same four countries, Saudi, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, and Qatar, to join in setting up a $750 million fund in the third OPEC summit meeting in November last year to invest in environmental technologies and to develop environmental technologies. That was a political signal to the world. We visited all of them as a response to that signal and to encourage that signal, what that meant, and we will encourage our allies and our friends to do the same. I would end by quoting the Saudi Arabia oil minister, Minister Al-Naimi, who said to us something that surprised us. He said, yes, not only do we agree with you that we should use profits from high oil prices to invest in environmental technologies and carbon catch and storage, but we also would like to share with you that we have high ambitions for Saudi Arabia on the renewables. I would like, he said, Saudi Arabia to be the number one country in the world on solar power. Now, I think that this is not necessarily a revolution, but I think it is a change of course with a few degrees, which in the long run will make the majority of petroleum-producing countries potential partners in combating climate change if we handle the international dialogue on these issues in the right way. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for those comments. I think they will definitely stimulate some debate here around the table. I do think the perspective that you've taken, which is recognizing that there is a need for the natural resources that Norway has and that those will be demanded in the market at the same time that you're developing the solutions, is an important one, because I think the question has arisen: will the policy of Norway towards petroleum development in the future be some way impacted by this choice? And it sounds to me like you're saying that you recognize there's a need for both approaches. But I don't know if you'd want to comment on that or not, whether there's an interplay between the pace at which you will develop your petroleum resources and the concerns.
Yes, I'd like to comment on that, because if we have dualities in our own self, there are also certainly dualities in the way people relate to us. When we meet with other countries, we sometimes meet the strongest allies and partners that are the most interested in our cooperation on the UN negotiations on global warming, on how we can contribute environmentally. And then we have others that may be working for the same government, who are primarily concerned with asking us that we should supply more oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So the duality is also there in how people perceive us. And what the present government in Norway has clearly stated in the declaration, or the platform that we agreed upon in the coalition, is that Norwegian petroleum activities will continue on a high, stable level. Meaning that when we speak to countries that constitute strong markets for us, we can comfortably assure them that we will continue to supply, and we will continue to look, and we hope to continue to find future resources. We still have a lot of unproduced resources, and the prognosis for yet to be found resources are also promising. We are turning from an oil to a gas nation. And this is in the international markets as an interesting commodity as oil, to have a lot of gas to sell. So we try to communicate the reliability that has made us invisible, the reliability that has made it possible for the Minister of Foreign Affairs saying to the European Union Commission last year, "We note that you take us for granted, and that's okay, because it means that our policy of being a long-term reliable supplier has succeeded." And at the same time, we have always worked the exploration and production of petroleum resources in a state-of-the-art sustainable way. I think that's fair to say. I would like to mention one example. In 1992, we introduced a carbon dioxide tax on production on the Norwegian continental shelf. That was very early. That contributed to the fact we have today, and that is that production on the Norwegian continental shelf emits one-third of the international average of carbon dioxide. This is the direct result, and this is confirmed by the companies, this is a direct result of the carbon dioxide tax. It means that when we continue to produce, we will aim for the, at any given time, highest environmental standards, and highest standards with regard to mapping whether new areas should be opened or not when looking to the required coexistence with other interests, not the least the fisheries. Because as you may know, Norway is also blessed with strong fisheries resources, and that is a renewable resource. And by definition, therefore, more valuable than oil and gas, because it cannot be depleted if we manage it correctly. So if we fear that fisheries will be impaired, then that will be a very strong impediment to future development. But we have, in the Norwegian Sea and in the North Sea, development and production of fossil fuels in, I would say, a good working relationship and good coexistence with fisheries, and we have worked it out. It is possible to do, but it requires vigilance.
My question relates to natural gas and to its future. You mentioned you would be number two among the world's gas exporting countries in not too distant future. Does that reflect successful operation of Snow White and Shtokman, plus others unknown?
when saying we will be moving from number three to number two natural gas exporter and not to a distant future, that reflects what we know and not prognosis for yet to be found resources. And it also cannot fully include Shtokman, because Shtokman is in Russian territory, Russian waters, and it's a Russian company. Norway has 24% in the project development company for Shtokman gas field, which is among the biggest in the world. And the final structure of how that will be, in what assets, values, and potentially gas that will be allocated to the Norwegian Statoil Hydro company in the context of Shtokman is yet to be decided. They are looking at an investment decision in 2009. So I think the most important perspective of Shtokman for Norway is the fact that because of Shtokman, there will be gas production in the Barents Sea, which is shared by the two coastal nations, Russia and Norway. And this means that even if Norway, contrary to belief and contrary to my assumption, should slow down or postpone development of gas on our own continental shelf, there will be Barents Sea gas exploration, and there will be transportation of gas along the coasts of Norway, indeed, quite possibly on Norwegian keels. It's a very relevant question. I have to share with you that the Norwegian Minister for Development and Environment, and I note in parentheses that we are the only country that I know of that have chosen to join those two portfolios in one man, development and environment. But he has a busy schedule. And in Norwegian papers yesterday and today, he is being lambasted for the fact that he has not included a huge part of the pledged money to deforestation in this year's budget. And he says that the reason I have not done this is that I've been very clear when I spoke about this in Bali, that I would not be giving out money before I was sure that the projects were good and that they were according to international guidelines and that they were long-term sustainability and that it was full acceptance of national and local and regional authorities. Now, that's quite a mouthful to accomplish, but he is right in saying that this is how it's going to be. And this means that with regard to deforestation, all options are on the table with regard to geography. I know we have good contacts with both Brazil and Indonesia, and I know that they are arguing their case, and there are good reasons to consider both of those. But that is certainly not to the detriment of interesting areas in Africa. The Congo Basin is one example. And the key criteria must be that we not only do it right, but we must also be perceived to do it right. And that's why we've embraced the concept of international guidelines to pursue it. And to be frank with you, I'm not quite sure that those exist yet. You make a very good point. I will leave a high-ranking American unnamed when I quote him in a Norwegian setting saying, U.S. energy policy is as follows. We ask other countries to develop energy and send it to us. And that's, of course, you know, only superficially true, but it led me to the realization of what you're pointing to, that is that the U.S. has chosen to leave a lot of fossil fuels undeveloped, and that I think 85% of offshore in the U.S. is off bounds by way of has been, you know, barred from development in a statutory manner, both from Congress and by presidential order. And I have to admit I'm a bit puzzled by it, seeing and having followed the very strong debate on energy security and indeed the concept of energy independence. And I'm thinking, you want energy independence, but you don't want to develop what you have. It is a bit puzzling, I have to admit. But, you know, I would agree with you on one point, that very few people know this. Very few people know this. I would say sometimes the U.S. is being blamed for not knowing what is happening in the other parts of the world. But sometimes it goes the other way around. And I would wager the assumption that most people in Europe, even well-educated people, believe that the U.S. has depleted its oil resources and is therefore hankering for others. I do not think that people realize that you have chosen for a multitude of reasons not to develop a lot of fossil fuels. You do, of course, do something, and just recently you had the lease round in Alaska, in the Chukchi, but that particular case illustrated some of the sensitivities that Mr. Pumphrey mentioned in his introduction, and that is that the minute that those awards, that those leases were being awarded, about 14 of them went to Statoil Hydro that had applied, and we were immediately lambasted at home for allowing our state company to explore in such vulnerable Arctic environment. And we were saying, well, the U.S. does have environmental legislation, and they have, you know, decided to put it up for... Didn't, and they were, of course, quoting Sierra Club as their proof of the validity of their points. So I think that we also need to look at the Arctic with, again, a certain element of reality orientation, in the sense that we are very concerned about the Arctic and the vulnerabilities there, but we shy away from doing what some NGOs do, and that is describing the Arctic as vulnerable per definition in its entirety. This is actually not the truth. There are parts of the Barents Sea that are much more robust than parts of the Norwegian Sea and the North Sea where we have strong petroleum production. It, granted, there are parts of the Arctic that are very vulnerable, but you'll end up doing that cause a disfavor if you describe everything as vulnerable when it's not the truth. And I will not have any view on the U.S. energy policy and the choices that should be made. But for us, it's very important to have a balanced approach and to look at to learn from the experience we have that it is possible to do this in a sustainable way. Well. I hasten to stress that my remarks were made purely as a politician. And that means that although I am a business lawyer in civilian life, I would have worded myself very differently if I'd given this as a legal presentation. Because being on the hook as producers, as the term you chose, I believe that is partly already... a reality in the political dimension. But in the legal dimension, it's ludicrous to look upon producers as liable. And again, I can quote President Bush, who said that we have too many lawsuits in this country, he said during his speech today. And in Norway, we have a very different culture on using litigation as a policy arena. And that means that the answer to your question is that on the domestic level, we have not identified a need to build any bulwarks against legal liability, but we are embracing the challenge of the political accountability that we feel is slowly developing, both from NGOs and in the context of the international joint efforts to curb climate change. But we are not doing this... We're not doing this to sort of preempt the issue. We are doing this because we actually believe in it. And that's why I say we're both the hammer and the nail. And it's many sectors that contribute strongly to carbon dioxide emissions. But we don't feel it's our place to point fingers at others and say, what about these guys in transportation and the cars and the planes and the ships and all of that? Because... others will do that. Others will have to tackle that. We think it's a bit unpalatable if we as big petroleum producers should point fingers at other sectors. We'll try to sweep for our own door the best we can without, in a meaningless fashion, proposing that we should stop doing what we do, i.e. producing fossil fuels.
I just had a question. You were talking about kind of your two-step approach to developing CCS, and the first part being developing these... two facilities on the western shore of Norway, and the second part being those are kind of laboratories for Norway and the world, is kind of what you're indicating. But the second part of your approach is a very important piece of making it deployable, mm-hmm. to not just the developed world and the countries that can afford. afford it, but also to the countries that might not be able to afford it that are going to be, you know, probably emitting more intensively in the next, you know, 20 or 30 years and beyond. I was wondering kind of what the stance of Norway is on the technology transfer question, and whether you're going to just give up that intellectual property because you see a benefit to mitigating climate change, or at what point do you see that the cost-benefit work out that, you know, we can give those technologies to the developing world?
It's a very good question, because it doesn't help to arrange a relay race if you don't have a guy with the last baton. And the situation is that we made a considered evaluation of that particular question very early on when we decided to pursue the issue of carbon catch and storage, because we are putting many hundred million US dollars into these full-scale projects, and we'll need to use to spend more money. And then, of course, the question is, what do we get for our money? And one potential route could have been to say that we will set up a Norwegian carbon cash and storage IPR company, and they will give all the money, and they will own all the intellectual property rights, and then we'll use that in technology transfer projects later on. That could have been one route to go down. We didn't do that for the simple reason that we do not think that government is very good at doing what industry should do. And it's always a mistake if you're tempted to be something you're not. And we decided the opposite route. We decided we will fund the projects, we will engage industry in developing both the know-how and the technology, because there's the whole range here. There's not only patent IPRs, but it's also know-how, it's industrial design, it's all of that, but it's industrial property rights, more or less protectable. And we decided instead to invite industry to come up with offers for being the ones to actually execute this, encouraging them to do it early and to also take, prioritize this project, and ideally, as Statoil Hydro and four or five other countries have decided to do on the test facility, to put up their own money, because then the future know-how would be the driver to incentivize and encourage them. So when we did not, when we chose not to to decide that IPR should be state property, then it was sort of available for industry to go after and chase after, so that they could do this early and give it priority with the ambition that they could reproduce and make money off of that later on. That is fine. I think it makes sense, but it doesn't address your implicit question, how do you get that step two? Well, I believe that that must be an international concerted effort online with other huge development projects. And Norway, indeed, will be fully prepared to be one participant in putting up the funds to enable developing countries to purchase the required technology and to purchase the required royalties. And I'm not excluding that there might be international agreements or even regulatory efforts with, for instance, compulsory licensing and all of that. But we think it is better to go down the route of incentivizing the industry to do what they do, and then to go down the regular and well-tried route of developing aid and technology transfer in that context to realize step two.
One of the questions that, in following up on the CCS debate, is: are you looking the question of how do we convert the cost that's associated with capturing and sequestering carbon and converting it into an economic opportunity? And clearly one of those opportunities is enhanced oil recovery, which I don't think has been used yet, but I would be interested in knowing what is happening on that on the Norwegian scene. But the other is finding ways to utilize the carbon that's captured for some kind of economic benefit, either in materials or something else, that can then be turned to a profit. Have you been doing any research into that end of the question?
No, it's a very relevant question. I'm glad you raise it because this is one of the areas that I really hope that technology optimism is warranted. And that is to get someone to find good use for this, to turn the waste product of carbon dioxide into an asset. And we've seen so many instances before of waste products turning into something that can be used for beneficial purposes. And I hope that this will happen. We've not done any research into it, but we have had many people knocking on our door with wild and less wild and even wilder ideas of how carbon dioxide can be transferred into this and that, and thereby binding the carbon dioxide from avoiding that it is being released into the atmosphere. So I hope that there will be sufficient commercial interest. And I think one of the first steps in getting these smart people to think along those routes of having a CO2 value chain is that we go ahead with actually capturing and sequestrating it, because then that's a business opportunity. People know if they come up with a really good idea, they'll be able to get hold of this very cheaply. Maybe even they'll be paid a small sum to take it away. And that's something that triggers, you know, the bright minds. And I hope this will happen. With regard to enhanced oil recovery, in Norway, we've already sequestrated quite a lot and we reinjected water. So the potential on the Norwegian continental shelf is unfortunately and apparently not very big. But we know that enhanced oil recovery by the use of carbon dioxide reinjections is substantial in other parts of the world. And this is one of the things that made the guys in the Gulf very interested, because the potential there is substantial on enhanced oil recovery. And I think that this is going to be another trigger that will make them channel funds and resources into that arena. And anything that brings us in the right direction is good.
Well, Madam Secretary, thank you very much for taking the time to visit with us today. This is very, very interesting. And as always, we very much like to hear what's going on in Norway, so we don't have a desire to have you stay out of the press. So you can join me in thanking her for her time.